May 7th, 2013. First item on the agenda is a, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 188A. Mr. Taylor.
Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 188A comes to you from Governor Kitt's offer for the Department of Corrections. Allows the Oregon Youth Authority to have release program for juvenile offenders committed to legal custody. Oregon Department of Corrections put place in the Oregon Youth Authority. Sets the terms and conditions of what they can do and what they can't do, and sets what they'd be covered if they were injured.
Okay, thank you. Karen Daniels and Kim Brockham, please.
Good afternoon. Rock, paper, scissors. Good afternoon, Chair Barker and members of the House Judiciary Committee. My name is Kim Brockamp. I'm with the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to testify in support of the engrossed Senate Bill 188 and respond to any questions you may have. What Senate Bill 188A does is it ensures certain persons committed to the legal custody of the Department of Corrections and housed in the Oregon Youth Authority may be eligible to do work release and could participate in work crews that the Oregon Youth Authority has. Research indicates employment and work experience is a critical component for successful transition back to the community. In Oregon Youth Authority, they have these types of programs for the juvenile offenders. DOC inmates have not been eligible to participate in those programs due to the statutory language. Currently eligible youth offenders in OA legal custody receive hands-on work experience and or opportunities for work crews. But DOC inmates living in illegal custody are bound by different laws which preclude them from participating in these opportunities. Some of the young DOC inmates housed at OIA are serving mandatory minimum sentences, also known as Measure 11 sentences, and are not eligible for any form of work release or leave. The engrossed version of Senate Bill 188 ensures that this work release provision will not apply to those inmates whose sentences were imposed under mandatory minimum sentence statutes or any provision of the law that prohibits release from any form of temporary leave from custody.
Thank you. Any questions? Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Honorable Jeff Barker and members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, I'm Karen Daniels, the Assistant Director for Facility Services with Oregon Youth Authority. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 188A and respond to any questions that you might have. As you've been advised, this Senate bill ensures that certain persons that are committed to the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, but in the physical custody of Oregon Youth Authority, may be eligible for work programs. Research indicates that employment experience is a critical component of successful transition to the community. So work release and work crews provide offenders an opportunity to develop employment skills and to gain experience to support successful reintegration, reentry back to the community. OIA currently provides programs and opportunities for our youth offenders, which they can develop these marketable skills. OIA and DOC both recognize the need to ensure these opportunities are also available to eligible youth in OIA facilities. But currently, eligible youth that receive these hands-on work experiences through programs to help them obtain employment in the community and release, while hundreds of DOC youth are not eligible for these similar programs. The bill is very straightforward, and many of these DOC inmates that are currently housed in OIA are serving mandatory minimum sentences, also known as Measure 11. They're not eligible for any form of work release or temporary leave. Therefore, the amendment passed in the Senate to Section 2 of the bill will ensure that this work release provision will not apply to inmates whose sentences were imposed under the mandatory minimum sentence statutes or any provision of law that prohibits release or any form of temporary leave from custody. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming to testify today. Karen, could you talk some about what kinds of jobs these kids on work release would go to, and also the transportation for them to and from?
Yes. They, currently, we have 10 facilities in Oregon Youth Authority, and of the 10, we have three that we classify as camps. They're Riverbend and Camp Florence and Camp Tillamook. We have a number of programs in those camps that have work crews, and in one of our programs, Camp Florence, we are actually conducting work-type experiences in the community. So that's more of a form of work release. So they are working in the community, gaining employment opportunities, wastewater treatment. We've had youth working for a veterinary hospital. We've done a number of fire prevention programs, forestry programs, parks programs. So we have work crews, and then we have developed these work release type programs where they're actually working for an employer and gaining that type of experience.
And follow up, so what kind of job would that be for an employer, and how would they get there to and from?
We would transport them.
Okay.
Our staff transport.
Okay.
Correct.
And what kind of job would that be, and what kind of industry?
We have a number. So, as I mentioned, the work release type programs have been with employers such as construction companies. We've had youth that have worked in a veterinary hospital, gaining experience and education in that line of work.
Great.
So it changes. Let me just say that it does change depending on the youth, their interest, and what employment might be available.
That's great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What types of crimes would youth commit that are non-Measure 11 that would cause them to be sentenced to DOC, under DOC supervision?
That's a great question. I can't tell you off the top, but I'll get that information for you and give you some specific examples.
Follow up, if I may?
Yeah.
So those are the types of crimes that we're talking about that the people would be eligible for under this bill. They're non-Measure 11.
Non-Measure 11, correct.
But they're youth, and for some reason they've been sentenced to DOC. So
correct.
That'd be good to have that information.
Yeah.
Thank you. And one more. Do you know the number in OIA custody today, the number that of youth that would qualify if this bill passed?
I don't have the exact number that are not Measure 11 representative. We have approximately a little over 300 that are Department of Corrections sentenced. So out of that, I'd have to get the exact number of non-Measure 11, and I can get that for you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cameron took my question. I think this would probably be a very pretty narrow group of people.
Very, very small.
I mean, because the way people wind up here is that, so when charged with and convicted of a Measure 11 crime, and please if there's any lawyers or anybody else out there, correct me, but my impression is when charged with when convicted of a Measure 11 crime, there's a blanket waiver in statute for persons 15, 16, 17 that assigns them to the Department of Corrections. First assigns them to Circuit Court, Adult Court, and then Department of Corrections upon conviction. Well, if they are convicted of something other than Measure 11, then a judge has to actually enter an order, has to affirmatively decide to waive them to Circuit Court. There's no blanket waiver in statute or anywhere else. And so state has to move the court to charge them and convict them as an adult. And from that point on, they're considered to be adults for any future crimes they commit. I would think, let's say a person is at some point waived by court order, specific court order, to the adult system. Well, if they had either enough convictions in that case to justify like a minimum property sentence, for example, you know, if you get enough thefts or burglaries on your record, you wind up in prison. Or if they convict another crime, if they get another crime after that initial waiver, that will get them in on a minimum property kind of offense, then they could end up in this situation that way. So, but that's why I'm thinking we're talking about a small group of people.
There's probably some also who have been played out of Measure 11. You know, there's been a, that doesn't work.
Mr. Chair, I don't think so. I think that if a person is charged with Measure 11 initially, but then convicted ultimately of something non-Measure 11, then the statutory waiver doesn't apply.
Okay.
And the court, then, but the court would have to affirmatively order the person to be convicted in circuit court and sent to the custody of the Department of Corrections.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 188A and open a work session. On 188.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 188A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 188A to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any?
Mr. Chair, I would like to see the explanation, the numbers of who are going to be eligible, and maybe some of the examples of the crimes or multiple crimes that certain people have committed to be able to be in that position. So I will be a no, but I possibly will reserve my vote to change that on the floor.
Maybe what I'll do is I'll...
Unless you need my vote. You don't need my vote.
No, I don't need your vote. But if you feel more comfortable with that, maybe we won't move the bill today.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
They can get me the information.
Okay.
And I can explain it away.
All right.
Need your vote no on the floor?
Yeah.
Oh, yes on the floor.
Be good.
Yeah. Call the roll, please. And how would you vote on that?
I vote yes.
If you'd mark down Garrett, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Open a public hearing on House Bill 622A. Call Wendy Johnson, Mark McKechnie, and Lane Shetterly.
Good afternoon, Mr. Vice Chair. Oh, I'm sorry, did you want Bill to give the rundown?
What I would like him to do.
Let him do that.
And sure.
So, Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 622 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, and it relates basically to records that are held in juvenile court, determining which records are open to the public, which are not, and if some of them are open to certain people and not open to others, depending on what their role is in the process and who they are.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lane Shetterly here in my capacity today as Chair of the Oregon Law Commission. Just by a few words of background and then a sort of a status check on this bill, and I'll turn it over to Wendy to let you hear the section-by-section explanation of the bill. This bill came to us from the Oregon Judicial Department, part of their e-court organization. One of the issues they're having, or they have with eCourt, is determining who has access to what records electronically now that we're moving into the digital world of court records. And in this bill and another bill you will be hearing relating to adoption records, eCourt has really highlighted some latent issues about who has access to what records and under what circumstances, in this case, in the juvenile arena. And so at the request of the Judicial Department, the Oregon Law Commission established a work group. You have a report from the Law Commission that identifies the members of the work group as a very broad-based work group that came forward through the Law Commission with Senate Bill 622. I can tell you that you have, I think it's dash 10 amendments that have been put forward. Because the Commission approved the bill as it was, as it is printed, I can tell you that we are passionately neutral on the dash 10 amendments, and we'll let you hear from the proponents of those. We certainly do not oppose. We're just neutral on those. The Commission hasn't taken a position. There is another set of amendments that have been at least forwarded to us from Judicial Department, Mr. Livingston, and those we would like a little bit of time to vet. So we don't have present you with the situation of having to make a determination about those amendments. And so would request after the hearing today where we give you the overview to perhaps set this bill again for next week hearing and possible work session. We will do our best to convene the work group to try and get a read on Mr. Livingston's latest amendments and then come back to you with a fully formed position with respect to those amendments.
Vice Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director for the Oregon Law Commission. As Mr. Shetterly explained, you have the work group report before you. In the room, we have a number of the members who participated on the work group. On page 4 of the report is a long list of people who participated, but we do have in the room OJD, DOJ, OPDS, the Juvenile Departments, Department of Human Services, and Youth Rights and Justice. So you got a feel for the who's all involved here. It's juvenile records, and it's both at dependency and delinquency because the same set of statutes governs both types of juvenile cases. So that's part of the reason why the statute's as complex as it is. It needs to address both types of cases. This bill does come to you from the Senate on a unanimous passage in the Senate Judiciary Committee as well as the floor. As Elaine explained, this project did come to us from the Judicial Department as a request, a big part of their e-court work, but it wasn't intended that e-court would be the driver. The reality was that the statutes have been unclear on who's supposed to be getting access, so then when you ratchet it up to e-court, it makes those ambiguities and inconsistencies even more glaring, and so the request was what is the proper access and copyrights of all records so that when we go to e-court, we don't have mistakes because the proper filing becomes even more important. The clerk of the court is responsible for maintaining the record of the case, and that continues with the bill. But what has been practiced is there's what's called the legal file and the social file in juvenile court, and that's different than your typical criminal or civil case at the adult level. Juvenile court is different in that we have these two types of files. There's never been an actual label in statute of what we call the legal and social file, and this bill actually comes up with two new terms, record of the case for the legal file and supplemental confidential file for that what we call the social file. So you'll see that term used throughout the bill. Juvenile court is different than other courts in that records are confidential. You have to be in the list of parties or persons that get access to look at these juvenile case records. In other words, public access is not provided, and that language is still maintained in the bill. In other words, we meant to make no changes regarding public access. It's now they're intended to expand or contract on what access is available to the public. Instead, we're really focusing on clarifying party access. Public records law also applies to some of these records, and we're not touching those provisions either. In contrast to records, or juvenile courts themselves are open to the public. And in the materials, we've cited the Oregonian versus Diaz case, and we're not changing that either. The public still does have a right to be in juvenile court in the presence, but this bill is about the records themselves, and we're not changing those provisions. Again, the reason for the project and the bill is that the records laws have been imprecise and practice has been inconsistent. Each county handles many of the records differently and puts them in different files, and so this is making it more consistent. And one example of why e-court will change this is you can't really return electronic record, and the statutes presently require you to return certain records, and so we had to adjust that and require destruction for some of those and just delete it in some places where it didn't make sense really to require a return. So that's another example. So the two main objectives are to define what's going to be in these two files, and then the second is to define who's entitled to inspect and who's entitled to have copies of these two files. Section 1 is the definition section, and we have a new definition of person, and the importance here is to make sure we cover public bodies and not just individuals, so we've clearly covered state agencies, for example, and the juvenile departments. Another new term is prospective appellate attorney. In juvenile cases, there's a right for representation, and OPDS uses their list of attorneys, but many times what they have is a prospective attorney that needs to look at the file, figure out if there's an appealable judgment, figure out if they have any conflicts with the case, and so they're not actually the attorney of record yet. They're the prospective attorney, and so they need some access to these files, and so right now there's kind of a gap in how practice really works. So we've included that new term.
Chair, can I ask a question?
Yes,
you can. Wendy, did you supplied the report, the commission report? Because I can't find it. Is it in OLS? I have extra copies. And I would say maybe I just can't find it on a list, but...
Does everybody want one?
Yes, please.
I only see the Hinkle testimony up there, so it could just be me being lost in a list.
That's true.
Thank you.
That's true.
It wouldn't be the first time.
So again, members of the committee, I'm speaking from page now 5 of the report, and it should be on OLIS, but now you have a written copy before you. So on page 5, I'm going through section 1. The next new definition is record of the case, and then also supplemental confidential file. For those two new definitions, we list what's to go in those two files. So for record of the case, we're dealing more about the filings, including the papers that... like motions and answers and judgments and affidavits and things. Some of these documents were not listed in present law in the kind of general list, and so we've specifically added answers, affidavits, and judgments to the list. They simply were missing from the present list. We've also added specifically the CRB findings and guardianship summary, and that's a new concept. There are guardianship reports that are required under existing law, but the materials in a guardianship report have what are considered the most confidential information regarding children, and so this bill would require a summary, basically that the report was done, that would go into the record of the case, but the report itself would go in the supplemental confidential file. Transcripts are added to the list. That's just for clarity. There was another provision elsewhere that said that transcripts are part of the record of the case if they're completed. And then moving on to sub 3, we really spelled out the exhibits that are offered and received would all be covered under the record of the case. That hasn't been clear in existing law. And then supporting documentation would also go in the record of the case. This could be like a cover letter or something, attachments and such. And then for supplemental confidential file, this definition is largely from existing law, but we specifically added the guardianship reports and made it clear because that's been an inconsistent practice in which file those go in. And now I'm on page 7 of the report. Both the record of the case and the supplemental confidential file definitions include electronic records to make sure that we're covering both paper records as well as electronic records. Section 2 is amending existing law ORS 419A.253. This is a relatively new statute that's unique to juvenile court in that it provides a procedure for the judge to either take judicial notice or to mark as an exhibit something that the parties haven't already provided and put into the record of the case, and it's a procedure to do that, and so there are just some changes to clarify that process. Basically, we were focused on the fact that there are only 4 doors to get evidence in, and that process needs to be clear and cleaned up a bit in juvenile practice, and the amendments were intended to help educate more than anything than change the law. Moving on then to Section 3, which is the main section of the bill. This is the section that lists out who gets what records and says that these records are confidential, they're not to go to the public. It's broken down into inspection for record of the case and copies for record of the case, and then inspection for supplemental confidential file, and then copies for supplemental confidential file. So you have pages here of we're trying to really show what we've added or subtracted from the list. I think it's pretty much all additions. So at the top of page 9, you see that in the middle there, it says section 3, who's already in the list to have inspection. The child, the ward, the youth offender, the child, the juvenile that's at issue, they will still have inspection rights. as will parents and guardians of that juvenile, and then surrogates and persons allowed to intervene, and then the court-appointed special advocate, the CASA, and attorneys. That's the present list for who can inspect the record of the case. And then we're adding five different additions. Judges were, we thought about taking that all together because it seems obvious the judge would have access to the record, but the problem is the existing law lists judge in one spot. So if we took it out, we'd have this interpretation issue, so we decided to put judge in all four spots so that it's consistent. So we're adding judge and those who are acting under the judge's discretion in all of these spots where it was missing. We're adding guardian ad litems for parents. This was an inconsistent omission. Guardians are not a party, but they're a representative of the parent, and the group agreed that whatever rights the parents have to access the guardian ad litem should have the same for them to meaningfully do their job. So we've added them. Service providers are added to the inspection rights because they were omitted. They have access to the supplemental confidential file but did not have access to the record of the case, and to do proper treatment and service, they need those records. They were getting them oftentimes from other persons, but this just makes it easier. We've added the prospective appellate attorneys. As I explained earlier, that definition, we need to include them with the other attorneys. And then number five, any other person allowed by the court. Mr. McKechnie from Youth Rights and Justice will go into it more, but there's a dispute over how much discretion other persons have, if there should be a catch-all or not. And the Law Commission decided to put this back in to specifically make sure that it was clear that other persons that were not on the list, the judge would still have discretion, and we still have it in the bill, but as Mr. Shetley explained, we're neutral on keeping that one addition basically held till July for a delayed effective date on that provision. It would automatically come in July unless the litigation...
Of 2014.
Correct. Until that litigation should be completed by then. So it would just automatically come in unless there were changes made during the 2014 session. So then moving on to copies for record of the case, we're adding a few folks. Right now it's basically attorneys and the state officials who get copies of these records in the record of the case. We're adding a few persons. We'd add the judge, we'd add service providers, we'd add CASAs. On that one, we think it's a mistake in existing law to omit the CASAs from this list because in the CASA statute, it says they get these records. And then prospective appellate attorneys again, and then the catch-all piece, we're adding it here, but as I said, this one would have a delayed effective on the catch-all.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. So this bill has been reconciled with the CASA statute?
Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, yes, this would add CASAs where they're not added so that they would have access to all pieces and be more consistent with what's practice and what is in the CASA statute.
All right.
On page 12, you'll see that there's a special note on parties in the case. The way the bill is written, in addition to the list of persons I've already explained, there's also copy access to those persons who are a party to the extent that they're permitted in these two other statutes, 418B875 and 418C285. The former is the dependency statute, and the latter is the delinquency statute. And there are some specific entitlements to copies in those two statutes, and so we're preserving access, copy access for those things that are listed in those two statutes, so we're cross-referencing. We had disagreement on whether parties should have access to the psych eval, and this leaves that issue still live by leaving it to the dependency and delinquency code, but we don't specifically address the issue. And there's a subset issue of self-represented parties. And again, we don't address the issue. We leave it to the courts, essentially, with what's in the existing dependency and delinquency codes specifically. So then on page 14, that concludes the record of the case part. The supplemental confidential file, that's generally the history and prognosis material or other materials that were never made officially a part of the record. There's oftentimes reports and things that are submitted to the court that don't officially become part of the record. Those things are kept in this other file. As I said, it used to be called the social file. With this bill, it will be called the supplemental confidential file. The way the bill is presently written, the materials that are in that file would have another list. You'll see on the bottom of 14, there's the inspection part. Again, this has actually been one of the most confusing areas of law. Everybody reads that long sentence in existing law in 419A255-2 and is not sure who it applies to, because it's a really long sentence. So we've broken it all out into a list. So for inspection of that file, the significant change is that parents, guardians, and guardian items will have access to that. We'll be able to inspect it, not take it with them, but we'll have be able to inspect it. It could be in the courtroom or with their attorney or such, but they are not allowed to have a copy of it. So that is an addition, and this is on page 15. And then likewise, guardian items would have the same access. And then for And this is dependency cases. In delinquency cases, they would have to provide consent, and that's existing practice, that parents of the youth or youth offender in a delinquency case can have access if the youth or youth offender provides consent or the court orders it as well. Again, we add prospective appellate attorneys, we add CASAs, and then we have the catch-all. And then for copies, the list is getting shorter here. We're just adding back judges and CASAs and the catch-all. As you can tell, the list for supplemental confidential file is much narrower. These are the most sensitive documents, and so the list of people who have copy access is intentionally quite limited. The rest of 418A255, the edits and such, are really about improving the organization and just making it clearer, and I won't go into the rest of that. On page 18, we talk about section 4, which regards transcripts and recordings. Basically, we're just clarifying the appellate recordings and making sure that that is indeed part of the record of the case. And some people were omitted from the list who have access, and we improved upon that as well in that spot. Section 5 is a new provision that was created for the Oregon Youth Authority and the Juvenile Department. Presently, they do not have a standalone provision for juvenile records. They relied on 419A255, which is predominantly used for the courts. And so they were both using, or all three, Oregon Youth Authority, Juvenile Departments, and the courts were using the same record statute, which has led to some confusion. So this bill with Section 5 would create a new section for the Oregon Youth Authority and the juvenile departments. It's not intended to change existing law, and that the juvenile records that are held by the juvenile departments and the youth authority would still be confidential. The history and prognosis materials would still be privileged. They have a list of who they can provide the records to that tracks what's in the list in 418A255, so it'd be consistent with that. And their provision also would prohibit unauthorized redisclosure, which is important. Section 6 puts in this new guardianship summary requirement. Normally, you're required to file a guardianship report every 30 days. And so when you do that guardianship report, you'd also provide a summary, so that could go in the record of the case. There are some other technical corrections in sections 7 through 11, but I won't go into those. In short, it's a complex, detailed bill to address all the various parties and different records that are filed in both dependency and delinquency cases, and we ask for your support.
Thank you. Art, any questions?
Go ahead. If you want. Mr. Chair, submit that the prior testimony by Wendy Johnson and all supporting documentation is and should be considered part of the legislative history on this bill.
Hey, thank you. Go ahead, Mark.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Director of Youth Rights and Justice. I'm here today specifically to speak to the Dash 10 amendments. We urge your support and adoption of the Dash 10 amendments, which would delay implementation of a small but important portion of this rather comprehensive and complex bill that you've heard about. Our position is that these, the words that would be, or the sections that would be delayed, change current law, and we feel that more time is necessary to consider the ramifications of those changes and also to allow the Supreme Court to decide among the different opinions whether the current law is changed by these sections or not. The Dash 10 amendments delay implementation of four subsections, which consist of four lines in the bill until July 1st, 2014. Those lines are on page 3, lines 29 and 36, and on page 4, lines 25 and 43. The current language regarding the court's authority, if any, to disclose confidential juvenile court records would remain in effect. Delaying the language allowing any other person allowed by the court to inspect or copy the juvenile court record or the confidential supplemental file maintained by the court until July 2014 will allow stakeholders to fully consider the ramifications of these changes. Children and parents who come before the juvenile court are some of the most vulnerable in our state. Many struggle with mental health issues, substance abuse, and other challenges that carry significant stigma in our society. The Juvenile Code has appropriately safeguarded these highly sensitive records, which can include psychological evaluations and prognoses, treatment records for alcoholism or drug abuse, information about sexually transmitted diseases, medical records concerning paternity, and graphic descriptions and evidence of physical or sexual abuse. Delayed implementation of the four subsections would allow time for the Oregon Supreme Court to rule on a pending case concerning the constitutionality of the juvenile court confidentiality provisions or decline to do so. It would then be possible to take further action in the February 2014 session if needed. So we are in support of the other provisions of the bill going forward as scheduled, and in order to allow those to be implemented and allow eCourt to be continue to be rolled out, we merely ask that the implementation of the juvenile court record release changes in statute be delayed and the Dash 10 amendments accomplish that. That is the only issue that those amendments address, is delayed implementation of those, the potential record release to any other person the court allows. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Taylor.
Ms. Johnson, we have mentioned briefly the case that Charles Hinkle spoke about in the Senate, and the Oregonian is suing for records, to have the records opened up, similar to what they did with Charles Hinkle 10, 15 years ago as it relates to juvenile court proceedings. If that suit is successful, what impact will that have upon this legislative proposal?
Chair Barker, Council Taylor, really depends on how broad the decision is. My understanding in that case that he's asking for dependency records, and right now there's no permission for there's no provision in this in the juvenile records to require disclosure of dependency records, and the Department of Justice is here as well, but that, you know, the work group was not under the assumption that Mr. Hinkle would be successful on that, because the court has never held that the open courts clause applies to records. Instead, they've only applied it to presence in the courtroom.
Okay, thank you.
And also, if I may, Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, I think what Mr. Hinkle also said in the Senate committee was that that suit was directed at the record of the case.
Judgment.
The judgment, that's right, yeah. So there, it's apparently a narrow, he's described it as seeking right of access to a narrower set of records than what we cover here. So even if he were to be successful, I think this bill may need to be amended to coordinate with the Supreme Court's ultimate decision, but most of it would still stand.
Thank you, panel. Tim Lowen and Michael Livingston, please.
Good Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Tim Lowen. I'm the Juvenile Apartment Director for Yamhill County, and I'm here representing the Juvenile Apartment Directors Association on Senate Bill 622. We are in support of Senate Bill 622. My county happened to be the primary and the first county to pilot e-court. And as you might guess, with anything new, there's hitches along the way, and we've kind of gone through a lot of this. But there's other counties rolling out right now. And part of the judicial department's sponsorship, I guess, of this bill is so they could clarify the process and who does receive these juvenile records. Historically, these records have been protected not only in our state, but in all states across the country. We have, in our situation of dealing with this particular part of statute, it has a history in that the county juvenile departments and the juvenile judges used to be together. And so this goes back to prior to the or mid-80s and before. So a lot of the statute that we've kind of altered here was really the basis for juvenile departments. And after the creation of Oregon Youth Authority, Oregon Youth Authority used this as well to protect their records as well. So Section 5 of this bill is a means to continue to have protection on our agency and department records, while at the same time modifying and clarifying the records of the case that the court has for the purposes of e-court. So the juvenile departments are in support of Senate Bill 622, and we would accept any questions or concerns you might have.
Any questions? Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Michael Livingston. I'm the Juvenile Law Staff Counsel for the Judicial Department. We've submitted three amendments to 622, the dash 7, 8, and 9. And as Mr. Shetterly noted in his testimony, what we had asked the committee to do is to hold off action on those amendments until we can have an opportunity to talk with the Law Commission folks to see if we can come to agreement on these amendments. There's a practical consideration in allowing that time. Also, one of the amendments addresses an ambiguity with respect to the provisions in the bill that change law to require exhibits in a case to be maintained as part of the record of the case. And we concluded in our fiscal on the Senate side that although that ambiguity might well have a fiscal impact, we did not have enough information to reach a conclusion that it would be beyond minimal. Since that time, we have additional information, including the comments and insights of a group of judges that we met with yesterday, 16 juvenile court judges from across the state. And based on what they said, and they included one judge whose county had recently implemented e-court, that unless this ambiguity is resolved somehow, it may well have a fiscal impact beyond minimal, which we would certainly be interested in eliminating. So there's a practical consideration allowing some more time. But overall, I think the real issue is I think both the Judicial Department and the Law Commission are interested in having the best bill and to catch anything we can now. And in that light, I want to say that Ms. Johnson particularly has done an incredible amount of work on a very difficult bill. It started out as a pretty narrow request for clarification, but I don't think there's any way to wade into this complex of law without making it more comprehensive than just that narrow view. So we'd like to continue to work to make this a better bill. And again, the practical consideration here is that members of the judiciary are going to be the ones that are applying this, and whatever ambiguities we can address and resolve, we'd like to do that.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Livingston, do you have any issue with the dash 10 amendments?
No, the Judicial Department does not oppose the dash 10s.
Okay.
Representative Krieger.
Judge Livingston, in the juvenile type proceedings, there's protected records, and then there's sensitive testimony, medical, mental health, and all kinds of things described. And are those courts and those proceedings open to the public, or is there anything that's so sensitive that it's not done in an open courtroom?
Vice Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee, there's only one provision in the juvenile code that closes testimony to the general public, and that's a provision in 419B, the dependency code, which allows the judge to take the testimony of a child in chambers. However, the attorneys for the parties have to be present when the court is doing that. I think that's the only provision in the juvenile code that limits the participants or witnesses in a proceeding itself. In other words, so the general public would not be in chambers listening to a child testify.
Thank you. Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And thank you for the parties for trying to get this bill fixed a little bit better. So we'll just close the public hearing on Senate Bill 622A. Any further business to come before the committee? We will be adjourned. Thank you, committee.